We are talking today with Aaron Glantz. He is author of the book How America Lost Iraq. Aaron Glantz is a reporter for Pacifica Radio and other media outlets. He has visited Iraq three times during the U.S. occupation. His work from Iraq has also been syndicated to newspapers around the world by Interpress News Service. Aaron is a founding producer of Pacifica Radio's national newscast, Free Speech Radio News. In the course of his work, he has also reported from Egypt, Turkey, Jordan, South Korea, Indonesia, India, Vietnam, France, and Denmark. Before becoming an international reporter, Aaron served as California State Capitol reporter for Pacifica's flagship station, KPFA, in Berkeley, California, where he won the California Journalism Award for radio in 2000. Aaron, thanks for spending time with us again today.
It's my pleasure.
You have just returned from several months in Vietnam. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I went to Hanoi, lived in Hanoi. It was my second trip to Vietnam. I made another trip in 2003. And, you know, the really good news about Vietnam is that, you know, after many, many years after the war ended in 1975 of the country being just a complete disaster of, you know, people tell you stories of the bad old days when they didn't even have enough wood or coal to cook with and they had to burn sugarcane chips to cook, that now people have gas stoves, now people have electricity, now people are getting around on motorbikes, and the richer people have new motorbikes, and the poor people have used motorbikes, or sometimes still bicycles, but there are less and less bicycles, and even a few cars on the street. And actually, even between 2003 and 2005, the government was able to take some of the money that it got from the development of the country and the more foreign investment that's coming in and have a larger expanded public bus system. And so now you can actually take the bus around Hanoi or Saigon, which was not the case even two or three years ago. So this is really the main action that's going on in Vietnam. Vietnam is now the number two exporter of rice in the world. It's the number three exporter of coffee in the world. And yet at the same time, the minimum wage in Vietnam is less than $2 a day. And so these, that you still have tremendous poverty amongst the people, and yet, you know, people are making a little bit more money, because before they're maybe making $1 a day, and now they're making $1.25 or $1.50 a day. And so there is progress, but people are saying, how much are we benefiting, you know, from this progress at the same time?
All right, and inevitably, in the media, when they're talking about Iraq and the U.S. occupation there, there's always parallels drawn to what happened in Vietnam. What's your take on that?
Well, one of the things that I did almost immediately after we got to Hanoi this time is I went to this organization called the Vietnam Union of Friendship Organizations. This is like a communist party apparatus that is kind of in charge of the ideology of the party. And so if anyone was going to be a good person to talk to about this kind of parallel, I figure I'd go talk to the communist ideologians. Having just spent all of this time in Iraq and written a book called How America Lost Iraq, about how I saw the alienating of Iraqi people by the U.S. military, wanting to know if he saw parallels. And the interesting thing to me was that he saw, you know, very few parallels between Iraq and Vietnam, as did most people I talked to. So, for example, he would say that in Iraq there was a brutal dictator, Saddam Hussein was in power, and America came in and removed that dictator. Whereas in Vietnam, America was propping up a dictator in South Vietnam that then the liberation struggle was trying to get rid of. He was also very critical of the insurgency or resistance movement in Iraq for the tremendous number of civilian casualties that they incur, and also for their lack of ideology. You know, he said when we were fighting the Americans, we had Ho Chi Minh, a unifying figure, and we had communism, which was an ideology that everyone was buying into. So all the Iraqis have is they have rage against the occupation. Their brother or sister or uncle or aunt was killed by the Americans, maybe in prison without trial at Abu Ghraib or some other prison, where the U.S. military now has 14,000 people in custody without trial, without charge. This causes people to get enraged and attack, but it's not kind of a coherent liberation movement of any type. And this is just some of the many differences that people would point out. But the longer I stayed there, and now I've made 2 trips to Vietnam and 3 trips to Iraq, that I see the main parallels, and the reason they don't see these parallels is because the parallels are all on our side. They're faced with these two very different situations. The U.S. military is doing exactly the same thing.
And recently we had traveled through Seattle a delegation of victims of Agent Orange, and I know that you have written about that. Can you tell us about that?
Well, right now there's a lawsuit that's been filed in court by victims of Agent Orange, Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange, and they are suing Dow Chemical and Monsanto, which made the defoliant that was sprayed all over the central and south of Vietnam. And this was sprayed, of course, so that the people who lived in those areas, the enemy, they could be easily seen. They couldn't hide in the bushes anymore. But unfortunately, there's dioxin in this Agent Orange. And now you have a third generation of Vietnamese babies who are being born with severe defects. Like, we're talking about people born with the wrong number of limbs. We're talking about people born with the wrong number of eyes. We're talking about people being born maybe with limbs that are so deformed that they're completely unusable, being born without certain vital organs, now in their third generation of this. And the Vietnamese government had always hoped that they could negotiate some kind of compensation for this with the Americans, because, of course, these chemical companies have negotiated with the American veterans who are suffering from toxic poisoning, and they were able to get a settlement many years ago from the chemical companies to help them with their suffering. But unfortunately, these same chemical companies are unwilling to reach a settlement with the Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange, and so now they filed a lawsuit in New York. And Agent Orange is really the single biggest enduring problem of the war. So you also have some other problems, like unexploded ordnance, like the U.S. military dropped tremendous numbers of bombs on Vietnam. But this is something that can be cleaned up. And you have 30 years now of cleanup that's gone on with these unexploded ordnance. And so the number of people who have been killed, you know, accidentally tilling their fields or losing a limb, accidentally tilling their fields. And we've met many people like that, bicycling across the center of Vietnam where the old DMZ used to be. We met a man who was tilling his field and he hit a landmine, it blew up. And it's a very common story, but it's happening less and less now. But the Agent Orange is hereditary. It's hereditary. So the people who are poisoned, the Vietnamese soldiers or civilians, they're passing it down, children, next generation to the next children. And this is a big problem. And I think you'll see something very similar with the depleted uranium that's been used by the U.S. military in Iraq. In Iraq right now, depleted uranium is not a big issue amongst the Iraqi people. They're thinking about, when I go to school today, am I going to be shot? You know, when I go to work today, am I going to be shot? Is there going to be a car bombing? Am I going to live through the day? Unemployment is 70%. Do I have a job? These are the things that people are thinking about on a daily basis in Iraq. They're not thinking about the long-term cancerous effects of these depleted uranium weapons we use, which is that there's uranium tipping on a lot of the bullets because it makes them go farther and pierce metal. And the same thing in Vietnam. You remember, during the war itself, napalm was the big issue. You drop napalm and it has the power to seep through people's clothing and burn them alive. And there are tremendous, terrible photos of this, and it galvanized opinion against the war. But the Agent Orange, at that time, it was not talked about as much because the health effects of it are long-term. And I would say that's probably another parallel between Vietnam and Iraq, is that there are issues that are not now among the Iraqi people, like the depleted uranium, but will become bigger and bigger as time goes on.
But I know even the U.S. soldiers, where they did get some form of compensation for the exposure to Agent Orange, at this point are still battling for health support for their exposure to different things, including depleted uranium that they suffered in Iraq.
Well, that's true, and that's also from the 1991 Gulf War, and you have this issue, Gulf War illness, which is this mysterious illness that nobody knows what it comes from, but a lot of people think it comes from the various chemicals, you know, that were used by the military in the war. And you have people coming back, and they're having to fight with the VA, but I mean, think about on the other side. I mean, I was talking to an American soldier back from Iraq, and he's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, which means that he cannot sleep in the same room with his wife because he might kill his wife if he wakes up having a bad nightmare in the middle of the night thinking he's back in Iraq. Now, at least he has a VA, however much bureaucracy there is, however terrible his experiences are. At least he has some kind of psychiatry that he can go to for help. Think about the Iraqi people. Now, they have not only been suffering through 3 years of American occupation, they have been suffering through 3 years of American occupation coming after 35 years of Ba'athist dictatorship. And they are not getting, they don't have any VA. And not only that, but they don't get to come home. They are home, and they're having to live through this on a day-to-day basis. And just imagine the kind of traumatic stress disorder that the folks over there are dealing with. And I wonder about the same thing, you know, in Vietnam. There's no psychiatry in Vietnam the way we practice it here. There's a lot of, you know, people helping their family members, you know, with crisis and dealing with the long-term trauma that people experienced during the war. But, you know, you have to wonder the crackdown that happened in 1975, where after the Americans fled, there were more than 1 million refugees from Vietnam and 400,000 people sent to communist re-education camps. I mean, how much of that revenge is directly the result of the trauma that happened during the war? And we're going to see something similar. I mean, eventually America is going to have to leave Iraq, and the situation will not be good. But that's just the way it's going to have to go.
No, I just thought it was ironic that, you know, the only, what appears the only support that, for instance, in Vietnam, that the people are getting there for their health problems has come from soldiers who had served in that campaign.
Well, the Vietnamese government, I mean, you could say it's because they're poor, or you could say that it's because they don't really care, they're disorganized, they ran the economy into the ground. For whatever reason, they have not been able to provide for the victims of Agent Orange. And the American government refuses to admit that Agent Orange did anything bad at all to the Vietnamese people. And this has been left out on purpose by the Clinton administration when they negotiated the treaty normalizing relations. They refused to include a recognition of Agent Orange in that settlement, and they refused to include in any kind of settlement over Vietnam's entry into the World Trade Organization, which is happening this year. But at the same time, there are a tremendous number of veterans of the war who recognize that something terribly wrong happened. Maybe they themselves are dealing with some of the terrible effects of the war in their daily life. And we met many American veterans in Hanoi who had come back to Vietnam, obviously maybe for the first time to Hanoi, to write the wrongs of the war. And there's a clinic called Friendship Village that's in Hanoi, where they're only able to help a small percentage of the people who are suffering from Agent Orange, and it's run entirely by private donations from veterans. Unfortunately, it's really a small percentage, and of course most of the people who are suffering from the Agent Orange poisoning are living in the center and south of the country, and they're getting almost no care, you know, from their government. And the Vietnamese government, I mean, a lot of people, you know, they support the lawsuit, but some people question, like, if they win the lawsuit, will the Vietnamese government actually distribute the money to the people, you know, who need it? This is another issue.
Well, you had mentioned earlier, and you have written about the situation with the number of prisoners in Iraq, and you pointed out in one of your articles that, in fact, since Abu Ghraib hit the media, that the number of prisoners has actually gone up?
Well, the real scandal about Abu Ghraib prison is that there are so many Iraqis incarcerated without trial in Abu Ghraib prison. So the International Red Cross estimates that 9 out of 10 people arrested and incarcerated as so-called security detainees are arrested by mistake. What does this mean? How could this be? One of the places that I went and did reporting in Iraq was Abu Sifo, which is a small village on the banks of the Tigris River, about an hour's drive north of Baghdad. And it's near a city called Balad, where the Americans have a large base. They call it Camp Anaconda. It used to be Saddam's military base, and we moved in, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. And it's under constant attack. So the Americans went looking for the people who were making these attacks, and they heard that there was a prominent Ba'athist in this village called Abu Sifo. But they didn't know who he was. So what they did was they came to the village in the middle of the night. They went to the largest house in town because he was a prominent Ba'athist. They ordered everyone out of the house. They machine gunned the house. They fired 2 shots from the barrel of their tank, destroying the house. But it was the wrong house. And then because they didn't know who they were looking for, they rounded up 83 men in this village that only had about 100 men. And when I visited the village 9 months after the raid occurred, 82 of the 83 men who were arrested were still in prison. And the only one who had been released was a 15-year-old boy. And he told me that pebbles were thrown at him to keep him from sleeping, that dogs were put in his cell every night, a different dog by a different U.S. soldier. And then he was released. And the only reason he was released was as a 15-year-old boy, he was transferred to a juvenile prison, which was run by Iraqis, and his mother had paid money to bribe him out. But everyone else was still in custody. And because of this, we now have 14,000 people in prison without charge in Iraq. These people are not allowed to see a lawyer. They're not allowed to see their family. They're basically held incommunicado, and they're released whenever the U.S. military decides that they're no longer a security threat. Well, imagine if you're one of these 82 people who gets brought in, who's innocent. You get worked over by the U.S. military. Well, of course they don't want to release you, because if you weren't a security threat before, you know, now you'd be pretty upset. And so you have a snowballing. When the Abu Ghraib prison scandal broke, there are about 10,000 people incarcerated in Iraq without trial as security detainees, and now there's 14,500. And the U.S. military is building another prison. It's actually Parsons Corporation of Los Angeles that's building it, and they're building it in the Kurdish region, where, you know, of course, most of these people will be taken from the Arab areas, taken away from their families up to Kurdistan. It'll be harder for their families to figure out what's going on. And this is not going to help bring peace to Iraq.
And that 14,500, that's just the ones the U.S. is holding. In addition, the Iraqi forces are also holding people.
Well, this is just the people who are the so-called security detainees. So the way the justice system works in Iraq is that there is some kind of justice system for criminals, for people who commit or are alleged to have committed robbery, assault, murder, kidnapping, you know, all the things that we consider crimes. Now, if you are considered to be a threat to the American military presence, then you are held by the Americans and you get no trial. And that's what I'm talking about here. These are the people who are arrested in these patrols. You know, our American soldiers, they go out on patrol in neighborhoods and they go looking for the insurgents. These are the people that get arrested when they go looking for the insurgents, but they really don't know who they're looking for. I remember this other guy, an auto mechanic in Mustan Surya, which is kind of an upscale neighborhood in Baghdad. And they have, the Americans, they have these large bases like this Camp Anaconda in Balad, which is going to be one of the 14 permanent military bases that they've been talking about. But they also have little small outposts all around monitoring neighborhoods, going out on patrol. And there's one in Mustan Surya. And so they went out, and their base is also under attack. So they went to this neighborhood, and they were looking for a guy named Mazen. But they didn't know who Mazen was, so they arrested like 50 people, including this car mechanic and his mentally retarded 14-year-old brother. And they took them in, and they interrogated, they hooded them, they beat them up, and they had only one question: who is Mazen? Tell us who Mazen is. Well, eventually they found out who Mazen was, and after a few days they released this guy. And this is not even counted within that 14,000 figure that I'm talking about, because they never make it to that security detainee stage. But there are additional thousands and thousands of people who get rounded up, and this particular guy has been rounded up and released 3 times. And it's a common story. You find it anywhere.
Well, and if you were saying that 83 out of 100 of that one particular village, I mean, that's an incredibly high percentage.
Well, because they are looking, they don't know who they're looking for, and they want to be sure that they get their guy. And, you know, I was on commercial radio station in Durham, North Carolina, where there's a, Fort Bragg is near there. And there are a lot of American soldiers who have been deployed to Iraq who were calling in on that program. And I've met American soldiers as well in the book tour. I didn't get to meet them so much in Iraq because as an unembedded journalist, I wanted to avoid getting accidentally shot by an American soldier. So I kind of stayed clear of them because they're in such a hellish war over there that it's best to, keep your distance if you're not embedded. But anyway, I've got a chance to interact with a lot of them. Nobody disputes the basic facts that I'm putting forward. People just make the argument that what else are we supposed to do? You know, this guy is shooting at us. He's going to keep shooting at us until we take him away. The locals, if we go around and ask them, none of them are willing to turn in the terrorist. This is the way they would say. They're not willing to turn in the terrorist. They're not willing to turn in the insurgent. And so then they have to go round up everyone. And I ask, well, why is that? You know, I remember this Sunni businessman in Adamiya that I met. He told me that he was praying during Colin Powell's presentation to the UN about weapons of mass destruction. He was praying that there would be good evidence to justify the overthrow of Saddam Hussein because his father and his uncle had been killed by Saddam's regime. But when I interviewed him a year into the occupation, two of his cousins had been arrested and were incarcerated without trial at Abu Ghraib prison. And so he told me it's the same struggle as under Saddam's regime. Now it's been replaced by the Americans themselves. And people like this are not going to turn in their neighbors if their neighbors are firing on American troops. So then the Americans, not knowing who they want, will be forced to arrest him and everyone else, you know, on his block when they come in looking for the person who's attacking them. And this will only serve to further alienate regular, ordinary Iraqi people against the occupation and cause the amount of violence to increase.
And compounding that, I believe I read in one of your recent articles a U.S. soldier saying that essentially the tactics they were using in Abu Ghraib, they were continuing to use. They were just being more careful about making sure that doesn't, you know, get to the press.
Well, I remember when the scandal first broke, and I was in Baghdad at the time, and there was tremendous outrage in Washington, and John McCain and various other people were outraged. But they were outraged not about the torture itself, but about the photos of the torture. And the Bush administration, of course, the ACLU then sued because there's a whole bunch of other photos that were not leaked at that time. And they sued, and the Bush administration stonewalled on giving over the photos for over a year. I think over 2 years they stonewalled on giving over the photos. And that's because the Bush administration doesn't want people to know what's going on because it will be bad for our image. But at the same time, they want to get they want to get information, you know, out of these detainees. But what I've learned in interviewing people who have been released is I'm sure there is some really horrific torture that's continuing in Abu Ghraib, but it continues with a small number of the detainees. You know, mostly what happens is people get arrested, they get brought in. When they're arrested, they're hooded, they're beaten, they're not fed well, they're warehoused in tents for a while, they get interrogated. And then the interrogators realize that this person knows nothing. But they have no mechanism then to release this person because they have no trials for these people. They just have this military review that happens 4 times a year. So somebody gets arrested, they get brought to Abu Ghraib, the interrogator finds out the person doesn't know anything. It's going to be 3 months that person's going to be held there before there's any chance at all that he's going to be released. Then you have these three U.S. military people who are sitting around deciding if somebody's going to be a continued threat when they know that they just worked over this guy and arrested him for no reason. If he does get released, he might be a potential threat. And they have orders from Washington to be very sure not to release the next Osama bin Laden. And so I was talking to Janice Karpinski, who was in charge of Abu Ghraib when the scandal broke. And, of course, because she was scapegoated, she's now sharing a lot of information about what was going on in there. And she said that they were forbidden from releasing anyone named Osama or anyone named bin Laden. And these are common names. You know, Osama bin Laden is only one guy, but a lot of people have the first name Osama. I have a friend, a very good friend of mine, who's named Osama. If he were arrested by the U.S. military, he would never have been released, according to Karpinski, who ran Abu Ghraib. So these things, they continue. And we know they continue because, you know, President Bush, you know, when the Abu Ghraib scandal first broke, he refused to be interviewed by Al Jazeera. But he did give an interview to Al-Hurra, which means the Freedom, which is the U.S. CIA-sponsored satellite television station to the Arab world. So it's almost like he gave an interview to himself. And he said, we will tear down Abu Ghraib prison. That was 2 years ago. now we're building, we're not only keeping Abu Ghraib prison open, but we're building another, newer prison. And we've also expanded the old airport prison. How secretive is this? It's so secretive that I was doing a story about this one particular detainee, a Kurdish politician, Ali Bapir, who had been arrested. And he's very well known in Iraq, and he's actually since been released. And he was arrested by the U.S. military. They invited him to a meeting. And this they do a lot with more high-profile figures. They invited him to a meeting to talk to him, and then they flew down a helicopter, landed it, arrested him, and took him not to Abu Ghraib, but to the airport prison where Saddam Hussein is being held. So I called the military to get their side of this story. And I said, I'd like to talk to you about Ali Bapir. And they said, we can neither confirm nor deny that we're holding anyone by that name. And I said, I can tell you that I have talked to his relatives, that they were there when he was arrested, and that they know exactly where he's being held because they've actually been allowed to visit him, which is not normal, but because he was so high profile, it was allowed. So you're still going to tell me that you can neither confirm nor deny that you're holding this guy? And they said, oh, sorry, we refuse to comment about any detainee. And then I said, well, they say he's being held at the airport prison. How many people are you holding at the airport prison? And they said, we can neither confirm nor deny that there is an airport prison. And this is a very well-known prison. Saddam Hussein is being held there. But this is, I mean, just imagine, you're not a journalist now. I mean, I'm a journalist. I can call the Pentagon. Imagine that you're a regular Iraqi person. If this is what I'm coming up against as an American journalist, imagine what Iraqi people are coming up against when they try to find out what's happened to their families.
All right. So you have recently, I believe, in your articles, questioned Donald Rumsfeld's comment about saying that pulling out at this point is not an option, and you had challenged that it is exactly a reasonable option.
Well, I mean, I was in Iraq in 2003 and 2004, and by 2004, when I came back after the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, the siege of Fallujah, where the U.S. military killed so many people that the municipal football stadium had to be turned into a graveyard for the dead, and all of that was broadcast on Al Jazeera, with women, children, and the elderly being the hardest hit, the lack of basic services, the lack of electricity in any reliable way, the 70% unemployment, the days-long line for gasoline in the most oil-rich country in the world. I'd seen all of this develop and endure over time, and I felt confident in 2004 to come back to this country and write a book called How America Lost Iraq, where I talk about the fact that the Iraqi people were initially happy that Saddam Hussein was gone, but did not buy into the Bush administration's program for them, and that the Bush administration misunderstood happiness that Saddam Hussein was gone for embrace of an American-led occupation and the Bush doctrine. So some people like Colin Powell are now saying that the problem is that we don't have enough troops there to keep the peace. But I say that the problem is that we have too many troops there, and that our troops have become the center of the violence. I'm at an auto mechanic in Adamiya, Sunni section of Baghdad, and he was in the resistance. And I said, oh, Mr. Auto Mechanic, you're in the resistance. What do? And he said, oh, me and my friends, we get together, we drink tea, we smoke cigarettes, and when the American patrol comes through, we hit it. And if no American patrol comes through, we bomb the police station because they're collaborators. You take the American patrol out of this, and this guy is just an auto mechanic. And a lot of other people are in the same boat. And so I'm not sure that the situation will get better if we leave. But we know, we now have a 3-year track record, that the situation will get worse if we stay. And we can't think that we are the only people who can make Iraq right. You know, imagine if you invited a plumber into your house. Or actually, imagine if a plumber broke into your house. And 3 years later, that plumber is still there trying to fix your sink. Only now, your entire apartment is flooded with raw sewage. Would you want them to stay there to clean up the mess? Or would you say, get out of my house, I'll fix it myself, and I'll send you a bill? This is the problem with the idea that we need to stay there until the situation gets better. We are the problem, not the solution.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, so I want to thank you for spending time with us again today.
My pleasure.
We have just been talking with Aaron Glantz. He is a Pacifica reporter and author of the book How America Lost Iraq. And you can follow more of his writings via his website at aaronglantz.com.